All right, thank you all for coming. Yes, as said, I'll be talking about Tor. We were introduced to this in the morning session, but I'll go over it briefly again, just in case some of you weren't around. And my work was improving Tor, coming up with a scheme to improve its performance, not from a privacy standpoint, but rather how to improve its latency so it's more widely used. And as you can see, it was done using a TCP over DTLS tunnel, and I'll get to that as well in some good time. But first, what is Tor? Tor is a tool to give users of the internet some anonymity, because as it stands, there's very little anonymity, despite perhaps a perception that it exists. And so the motivating example for why we need anonymity on the internet is because not everyone has equal access to the internet. And in particular, if there was a citizen here in China who wishes to access Radio Canada, they cannot make a direct connection to Radio Canada to access the news because it would be censored by the government. So instead, what they can do is make use of Tor to hide their IP address. And this prevents an external observer from knowing these two parties are communicating. And how it works is it stands in the middle as a network of routers. So when he wants to make a connection, he instead puts that connection into this network. It goes through it in some way such that on the other end, when it comes out, no one is able to determine who is speaking with whom. Of course, if anyone were able to observe the entire network, all privacy is lost. There's no goal here in trying to make it completely anonymous against all kinds of observers, but rather just pragmatically anonymous against the standards observers that we'd expect. Perhaps a government that can view some slice of the internet, or one hostile node that is compromising the security of traffic that it passes. So to make a connection through Tor, he first chooses one router, connects to it, then to another, then to another, and then finally to Radio Canada. And when all of these nodes are communicating, they are only aware of their direct neighbors. So the first node, let's see, this one here, is aware of the entity that is initiating the communication. This node, however, in the middle, is only aware of this node and that node. And of course, the last node is aware of Radio Canada, but has no idea of the identity of the person who has initiated the connection. So it is through this way that the anonymity is achieved for our citizen here who wishes to get access to the news. So as said, it's privacy for usable low latency communication. And the key here is usable. Usability is a very important goal for Tor. They want to make sure that installation is as simple as possible, a one-click installation. The fact that usually you have to forward a port at your firewall to be volunteering as a router is enough work on its own, that's the most extra work they want to have you do other than just a one-click simple install, very usable. And also, of course, low latency. It's meant to be for interactive tasks such as web browsing. And as a result, if ever it is slow, and it can be slow, it immediately acts as a disincentive towards usage. We want to make sure that everyone can use it if they want. Everyone can have an anonymous internet, not just those who need it. So we want to ensure that it is as fast as possible, that latency is kept to a minimum. But there is an observed latency, and it goes beyond simply an increased network distance. We know that we're traveling, making our traffic travel much further throughout the internet. That's going to add some latency. But in some experiments, we found that this latency goes beyond just what the networking distance would account for. So the question becomes, where is this observed latency? So here we have a model of the data path for Tor. The Onion proxy, this is the first node, the client. This is the person who's initiating the communication. He's communicating through a sequence of Onion routers, and then finally to the server, which in the picture before was Radio Canada. It's done with sockets, so the information is traveling over the internet, and at each destination, the data is put onto an input buffer, processed by the router, sent to an output buffer, and then forwarded along the socket. So in some experiments that we did where we looked at the computational cost, Tor uses a lot of crypto, it was negligible. So the routing, all the computation, that was not a problem at all. But we had the idea that perhaps data could be sitting on these buffers. Indeed, if it were sitting on these buffers, then this would be a source of latency that goes beyond the networking time, and that would not necessarily be, that could potentially be a serious cost. So we did an experiment where we had a live Tor node running at our university, and we instrumented it so that every buffer that it was managing, it would record the size and the time whenever it changed. We did this for input buffers, and we did this for output buffers. And the goal was that afterwards, we could re-simulate it as a queuing model by tagging data as it entered the system and then figuring out how long it spent waiting in the buffer as a function of the experiment's time, and then see if this was indeed a problem. So we did it for input buffers, and we found it was not a problem at all. Input buffers are immediately fast. However, for output buffers, it can be some trouble. So this is a graph of how long data spent waiting in one particular output buffer for actually a very well-functioning buffer that was able to move a lot of data. In this top left graph, what we have is along the x-axis is the experimental time, and along the y-axis is how long data that entered the buffer at that time would have to wait. So we see for most of the time it's actually quite reasonable. It's not waiting any longer than the time it takes to be put into the buffer and then removed as a result of just a lot of data going into the buffer. And this graph is the size of the buffer as a function over time. So we see lots of data is put in, then it's removed. However, there are occasional spikes where data is sitting on this buffer for some amount of time. I should say on the right is a cumulative distribution function for these two graphs on the left. So the question becomes, well, this is one buffer that actually is quite well functioning, is able to move a lot of data, it is able to keep up with the demands of the network, and yet it still has these periods of 100, 200, 300 milliseconds of latency of just sitting on the buffer doing nothing. And the question is, what is causing this latency? And the reason is that the socket is just unwritable. So there's no, it wants to do a write, and the reason, or the way it works is there's a tool called libevent, which multiplexes all of the sockets and handles all the file I/O with one single thread. And it waits until an operation is ready, a read event or a write event, and it only performs these operations when the file descriptor associated with it is ready for that operation. So it only does it when it is assured that it will not block. So when the socket reports itself as being unwritable, then the data will end up being back buffered into Tor's own output buffers, and that's when we see them start to grow, and that's when we see some extra delay being added. So why would this socket be unwritable? So a brief outline of TCP. TCP is used to reliably send streams of data over the internet using the medium of packets. I'm sure we're all quite well aware of this, but the point is that it's sent reliably despite the fact that packets can be lost or reordered or arrive twice. And it achieves this reliability goal by buffering every piece of data that it sees. So internally, whenever it gets any data, it maintains a local copy and maintains it until it has received an acknowledgement that the peer has received that data successfully. When it has such an acknowledgement, then it removes its local copy. Moreover, it has congestion control properties where it will throttle its own sending if it perceives there is congestion along the way. Instead of continuing to exacerbate this problem by sending more data through the network when it knows that packets are being dropped, it instead throttles its own sending severely so that it can help relieve congestion in the network. So at any one particular time, we'd expect in the operating system its output buffer to consist of some amount of data that is sent but unacknowledged, some amount of data that is has ready to be sent but is being withheld for congestion control, and then in the rest of the buffer, some empty space. And this is this graph here. And this is, again, for one buffer in the operating system level for our public Tor node that we are running. And the graph here is a graph of the contents of data in the buffer, how much data is sitting in this buffer. And that is the vertical lines. It goes to the top of the buffer, where this horizontal strike indicates the size of the buffer that the operating system is allowing it to grow to. And what I've done as well is marked with these circles the number of unacknowledged packets, the number of packets in flight, and I scaled them by the size of the maximum size of TCP packets. So it's not exact, but it's more or less an upper bound and a very good estimate. Since it's moving a lot of data, the packets tend to be quite full. So we see at the bottom some amount of data is waiting for acknowledgement, some amount of data on top of which is being throttled for congestion control, and at the very top, we mark with X's whenever the socket reports itself to be unwritable. So, as expected, the socket reports itself to be unwritable because congestion control is being triggered and it is buffering the data inside. So when we were seeing a couple hundred milliseconds of delay inside Tor, we were also going to be seeing even more delay in the operating system level because its own buffers are full and congestion control is being triggered to not send so much data. So Yes, the naive conclusion, congestion control is to blame, except we can't possibly expect to mitigate congestion control and gain anything. It serves a very necessary and important purpose in network management, and so we can't tamper with that in this regard. However, what we can note is that there is a flaw in Tor's use of TCP that further makes this problem worse. In particular, when there are two circuits here, A and B, and they go over the same pair of ORs, then there'll only be one TCP connection for both circuits A and B. So when building a circuit, if A arrives at this OR, notices that this B circuit already exists, it will recycle this TCP connection for both the traffic of A and B. As a result, there's only one connection to which congestion control can be applied. And if A is a circuit being used in America for BitTorrent, and B is a circuit being used in Iran for a Twitter message about a protest against the government, then the messages for B will be much harder to get through because it'll be throttled as much as they're throttling the large bulk transfer that A is pushing through the network. And this is suboptimal. This is precisely goes against the goal of congestion control, which is to ensure that B can get its messages through. There can be useful delivery for all circuits, despite the fact that A is indulging in a large bulk transfer. So we look to see if we can see this problem actually occurring inside our Tor node. And this is a result of data moving through the buffer of one of our sockets, or of one of our connections. So I've demultiplexed the two circuits that are sharing the same connection. Those are those two series. Along the x-axis, we have the time of the experiment in seconds. And along the y-axis is how much data has moved through the buffer. So imagine tagging each piece of data as it arrives, and that would be the y-axis. So these shapes are constructed in such a way that the left side of the shape rises when data enters into the buffer, and the right side of the shape rises when data exits the buffer. As a result, if this were the ith piece of data, on the left side of the shape is when it enters, on the right side is when it exits. Whenever there's a period of area, such as this area, or this area, or this area, this corresponds to data sitting in this output buffer inside Tor, not doing anything useful at all. And what we notice is that one of the circuits writes in these bursts, and each time it writes in a burst, there's a corresponding delay in the other circuit. So we have here in Tor two circuits that just happen to be sharing a connection, but other than that have nothing else in common. And as a consequence, this one is able to cause interference on the other one. So we look, can we replicate this locally? And the answer is yes. We have a local network of Tor routers running, and we set it up with latency between each. We were adding artificial latency, and we built two circuits through the same set of routers. And we measured the latency on one circuit, and we found it to be about 300 milliseconds, precisely what we were expecting with our artificial latency we were adding. And then we started a large bulk transfer on the other circuit and measured the latency again on the first, and we see that it has jumped to over a second. So we are able to replicate this problem of cross-circuit interference locally. As a thought experiment, you could consult the paper for actual experiments, but if we have a packet getting dropped on a TCP stream for one circuit or for one connection, but here each individual shade corresponds to packets or cells for different circuits, what we see is that in the operating system, there'll be two cells available that are readable for two different circuits, whereas other cells that are perfectly valid data to be read will be waiting because this packet has been dropped. So we have a head-of-line problem here where no data that is here buffered can be read, even though it corresponds to useful data that we could be processing and sending further along in the network. So we conclude we'd like to use a separate TCP connection for each circuit. This is certainly a more appropriate use of TCP and a wiser use of TCP for this application. And the question becomes, well, why wasn't it done this way initially? And the answer for that is that it would leak a lot more information than we wanted to. It would tell an observer how much data was being sent through the network at all times, when circuits were being built, and cells traveling along on a per-circuit basis. And we wanted to hide that information from an external observer by amalgamating them all together into one connection so that they couldn't take them apart and determine which cells were for which circuits. Moreover, there's some scalability concerns that exist. As it stands, any Tor OR can connect to any other Tor OR. This opens up a lot of sockets, making it so that each circuit has to have its own socket would strictly, or at least weakly, increase this number. And moreover, some versions of Windows already have problems running as Tor routers simply because of the demands placed on the number of sockets they must open. They can't cope with opening thousands and thousands of sockets. Finally, we conclude that if we are making a change, it must be backwards compatible with the existing Tor network. It's been around since 2003, has never had any downtime, and has thousands of volunteer routers running various versions, and has an unknown number of clients estimated in the hundreds of thousands, some of whom need Tor to get Tor, and we can't expect them all to upgrade on the same day and nothing to go wrong. So it has to be introduced gradually, adopted, and improved and accepted in that way that is backwards compatible with the existing network. So I'll take a sip of water and then the proposal, which is a TCP over DTLS tunnel. So DTLS is the datagram equivalent of TLS, transport layer security. When you want to secure a socket, and it's a UDP socket, then you should use DTLS because that's the standard for it. And what we're going to do is we're going to separate all the circuits for the connection because this is the appropriate thing to do, but we still want to secure the header, so we send the entire TCP packet over a secured channel. So now the header is secure as well, and we're sending TCP packets between hosts over DTLS, over a UDP protocol. So we still have all the benefits and necessary components of TCP, reliability, in-order delivery, and congestion control properties, but it's being handled inside Tor in a user-level stack. So we are using a stack, or a TCP stack inside Tor to generate the packets inside the program and then sending them over DTLS to our peer, who receives them, decrypts the packet to end up with a TCP IP packet, puts it into his user-level stack, and reads from the appropriate stream. So as a diagram to how this addresses our problem, here we have the packet format for the original Tor. We see that it is a TCP IP packet secured with TLS with an application payload. I put this in gray to indicate that this is the secured component. Our proposal is to continue securing the application payload and also secure this other header, which is just a compressed version of the TCP header containing the information about which circuit these cells belong to. Basically, the information that we wanted to ensure an adversary couldn't see, we secure it as well along with the application payload, encrypt this with DTLS, and send it over UDP. This also has a nice benefit that UDP can operate in an unconnected mode, where you need to only open one socket in the operating system, and you can use it to multiplex connections for as many different peers as you want. Whereas TCP requires long-lived connections. Once they're built and established, you must keep them until you close the connection. Instead, UDP can act as a deliverer of any to any address. You provide it with a packet and the address, and it sends it along. In the same way, when it receives a packet, it tells you who sent it. And you can use the address of who sent it to determine the key you need to use to decrypt it, which DTLS session that is that it corresponds to. Take that key and the packet you've received, bring it to DTLS, and you end up with a Tor TP packet, which you then translate to the according TCP IP packet, inject into your user-level TCP IP stack, read from the appropriate stream, end up reading up a cell, then performing the Tor operation on that cell, writing it back to the user-level TCP IP stack, which may or may not generate a packet that it then forwards on to the next host over DTLS. What's nice about this as well is that it is backwards compatible because it's only a new transport layer for Tor. If a node cannot communicate, if it doesn't choose to advertise a UDP port, then it just simply continues to use the existing TCP transport. So we're only adding a new way of transporting between two pairs of nodes, and if they choose to use it, if they both can use it, then great. Otherwise, they continue using the existing version. So as a system diagram, I have here on the left the component of Tor, and this is our user-level TCP/IP stack. We're using this as a component of our program, and it acts as a box that translates between streams and packets. So when we call user-level versions of send and receive, it handles all of the buffers and the sockets, file descriptors, retransmissions, congestion control, and such. And on the other side, it just emits a packet. And instead of TX and RX, which would normally be sending directly to the network card, instead we hijack them to come back to Tor, and instead use DTLS to encrypt, send over the UDP socket. Again, when something arrives, we can decrypt it, pretend that we just received it. The user level stack says, okay, now this socket is readable. We receive, unpack the cell, process it, and then so forth. How does this address this, the head of line problem, as mentioned before? Well, it's no longer a real dropped packet because it's not coming in a stream. This is just a bunch of UDP packets, some of which, or one of which happens to be missing, but there's no way of knowing that, except inside the user space, inside the user level TCP stack, it realizes that data is missing right here. However, these three circuits are all readable because they're no longer connected. So experimental results from our implementation. So we implemented this, and there's more results in the paper for different experiments, but the most important one is, yes, we managed to successfully address this problem that we had before. So this was the experiment where we had a local network with adding artificial latency, and we measured the latency of one circuit when it shared the same set of ORs as another circuit, and when the one circuit was idle and the other one we were measuring latency. This is our version of Tor and the existing version of Tor. We see that it's about the value that we expect. However, when we add the large bulk transfer on the other circuit and the latency of the one jumped enormously, instead we see basically what we expect because they are separate TCP streams. And when congestion control is being applied, it doesn't throttle our circuit that is just trying to send a little bit of data through. So, some future work. What we've done is we've moved the TCP stack inside Tor, and this means there's a lot of interesting things now that we can do. They wanted to originally, when they had Tor, to do some stuff, but they had no access to the operating system. They couldn't expect people volunteering to start tinkering with their kernel. Now we can actually start tinkering with the TCP stack and optimize it completely for Tor. So in this way, there's future work in that regard. One thing that would be quite nice is instead of having lots and lots and lots of buffers, most of which are empty most of the time, and even have the concept that it's unwritable because it's out of memory, instead, when data arrives into the system, you just put it into an empty cell. All the cells in Tor, they're all fixed size. So when data arrives, you put it into an empty spot in the cell pool, and instead of having buffers, you just maintain linked lists through your cell pool, which is the set of empty cells, which is the input buffer for one particular socket. And we can see this scales easily for as many sockets as you want because they're all just linked lists. We don't need to allocate any buffers. And this also has the nice property that instead of copying data five times through different buffers, we just change these linked lists. We don't ever have to worry about running out of memory, and suppose that if we did run out of memory and this cell pool was completely full, all we need to do is stop reading in more data. We have our UDP socket and data is arriving from it. We read a packet, but we just throw it away. What ends up happening is, since we didn't put it into our user-level TCP stack, no acknowledgement will be made. And the person who sent it will assume it was dropped. And they'll assume it was dropped because there was congestion, and they'll trigger congestion control. And that's exactly what we want, because we are congested. If we've run out of memory, we have no place to put data, then we want all the people sending us data to slow down so we can have a chance to catch up. And then once we have room again, we can start reading in some more data. Another interesting thing we could do is have congestion control be applied to the entire circuit. Right now, Tor has a problem with asynchronous bandwidth, where you can download a lot more data than you can upload. And as a result, you're happy to accept lots and lots of data, and you send lots of acknowledgments, and the person sending you data thinks everything's great and keeps sending you more until you run out of room. And the reason is you can only upload with 1/10 of the speed that you can download, or throughput, rather. And so congestion control in this way could be if this last node would say his TCP congestion window that his user level stack is telling him to use is 10 packets, he can report this backwards when he sends acknowledgments. And if this node here wants to send, if his TCP stack is telling him to send at 20, he can down throttle himself to 10 if told by this guy, hey, you can send at 20, but I can only send to the next guy at 10, so there's no reason to do so. And again, it can be sent backwards. Now, this opens an obvious privacy problem in that we've just established a direct channel for this node to communicate with this node. If he wants, if he can use conspicuous numbers, and then he can determine he's talking to him and such like that. So maybe this node can lie. This is what, I guess, makes it a research question. And tuning it, making it so that it actually works and seeing if it is as effective as we thought. So in summary, we determined that TCP congestion control introduces latency into Tor's data path. We determined that multiplexing circuits over TCP results in the unfair congestion or unfair application of congestion control, particularly against those that aren't sending much data when they're faced against those sending lots of data. And we proposed TCP over DTLS as a solution to address this issue that also addresses the scalability concerns that we had and is backwards compatible with the existing Tor network. And finally, we implemented our proposal and showed that it successfully addressed cross-circuit interference. Thank you. Any questions? Yep.
Yeah, we have a few minutes for questions. Please state your name.
Michael Sirivianos from Duke. So what if you had TCP congestion control only at the ends, and you had Tor being just an IP level tunnel? I'm not sure. So if you didn't have TCP connections between the routers.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you're saying if you have TCP at the ends and you use UDP. So this was something we were looking at as well originally when we were doing this research. It turns out that congestion control works best on short distances. So the further, the greater your round trip time, the less your throughput. So it's always more optimal to have short distances, and TCP works better in that regard. You achieve better throughput.
So this is very intuitive. The connection, that's they call connection splicing. Mm-hmm. So this, for the traffic, for the workload that Tor has, this will be very bad. You say if you rely on the ends only.
Yes,
I'm 100% sure that this is the case. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if it's an exception for Tor. But yeah, thank you.
There is time for another question. If not, maybe I may ask a question on a subject that I'm not an expert in. You mentioned the number of copies being a potential problem.
A number of what, pardon?
The number of data copies. How many?
Oh, it's not a problem in latency, but it's just something that would be nice, I guess, from a machine perspective to not copy the same piece of data 5 times to different memory locations.
I see, yes, because you're making some amount of copies in any case.
Mm-hmm.
If there are no other questions, then I thank the speaker again.